Distributing the Future broadcast November 27, 2006, Finding Your Voice.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. We have three pieces this week that hover around a theme of finding your voice. Google CEO Eric Schmidt talks to John Battelle about the corporate voice that Google has taken on. Moshe Cohen is a clown who performs using his voice but no words. In many of his missions, including Clowns Without Borders USA, he cheers people up but also leaves them with a deeper lesson. I've remixed a piece by David Bettino from the Digital Media Insider, which looks at how much computer voices have improved. This is our last show for 2006. We've probably done about 50 editions of Distributing the Future by now, and it's been a lot of fun. Thank you for listening and for sending in your suggestions. We hope to bring the show back sometime in January. In the meantime, you can listen to some of the other O'Reilly podcasts, including our series from the recent Web 2.0 Summit. You can subscribe to either the video or the audio feed. This week, Google's Eric Schmidt is the featured guest, and here's an excerpt of his conversation with Summit Program Chair John Battelle.
There have been many examples of companies that have had better products that have been rapidly adopted and then have become sort of the standard, and then sort of something sets in. The community starts to worry that that company has too much power. People start to plot against the company. People start to try to figure out ways to compete around that company and so on. Do you worry about that?
Sure, absolutely. And what we do is we run the company around end users. And so the way we think about that question is, as long as we're respecting the rights of end users, who we care a lot about, as long as we make sure we don't do something which is against their interest, then we should be fine. If you look at the historic large company behavior, they ultimately do things which protect their own business practice, monopoly, what have you, against the choice of the end user. So the more that we can, for example, let people move their data around, never trap the data of an end user, let them move if they don't like us, the better we think we'll be both genuinely treat our end users and be perceived as well.
I wanted to ask you about that data. This is a big topic. I think, as Tim said, data is the intel inside. You've got a lot of intel. Your approach towards users has been, we will protect your privacy. But what you just said is actually interesting to me in that, can I get all of my search history and export it to another, to Yahoo?
We would like to be able to do that. We are working to make sure that as long as it's yours, so it has to be appropriately authenticated, you have to have a login name and a password, we want to give you essentially the equivalent of number portability. Mm-hmm. Because we think that that is ultimately the if you will, the pressure valve on bad business practices on our part and on others as well. As long as people feel that if they don't like what we're doing, they can just switch, then that keeps us honest and keeps everybody else honest as well.
Let me give you a scenario, and then we're going to move into another thing about Web 2.0 where we had a conversation backstage, and I want to talk about that. Let me set up the scenario. Google has done two things in the last year and a half or so that I think were, I guess you could say, almost honorable. Number one, you stood up to the Department of Justice and made a case out of their subpoena of 35 or so companies. They asked for your entire search index, and they asked for, as I recall, a week's worth of queries. And they wanted to go fishing with that. And you said no. And they then...
But I mean, you're describing it in this very nice way. Let me just say that if you think of it from an end user, why would an end user want that done to them unless they're at all near some crime?
Right.
It's a complete violation of people's privacy.
Right.
And a federal judge, thank goodness for federal judges, saw the wisdom of our argument and ordered a restriction of that, and it was a very good outcome.
Now, had you not done that, it would be entirely possible that no one knew about this because actually most of the other companies involved didn't make a fuss, and so journalists like myself couldn't actually, there was no court case that we could go look at and find out what was going on. So that was, from my point of view, a great thing. before that, when you went public. So basically, you on principle stood up, and obviously there's good reasons to do it as well, because you don't want your index in the hands of anybody. It's your index. But you in principle stood up to the Department of Justice, to the U.S. government. When you went public on principle, you stood up not to Wall Street, but to a lot of the practices of Wall Street. The way that you approached the IPO, you stood up to a very powerful force in the way Wall Street likes to get things done, and you did it differently. So here's my scenario. Under the Patriot Act, under the principles of which you are not allowed to disclose that you are being asked for information, you are asked for something that you believe is morally wrong. Would you stand up to it?
We will do whatever it takes to follow both the law and the principles of the constitutional
but
government.
But what if it's against
the
law?
Well, then we'll have to talk to a judge. Ultimately, we and all of us in this room are subject to the law of the United States as we sit here. And we have no question as to whether we're subject to that. We don't think we're citizens of some other planet. So the fact of the matter is we are subject to that. But one of the great things about America, on a day in which hopefully everybody had a chance to vote or voted by absentee ballot, is we have a system of law, we have a system of review, and we won't win everything, but we're going to try very hard. And we will absolutely follow the order of a federal judge.
Well, I very much hope that we will have a case that breaks this out, because I think that...
Hopefully it won't be us.
Well, as
no, the question you're asking is that there's clearly going to be somebody who's going to test the limits of the Patriot Act.
Right.
Patriot 1 and Patriot 2. And it's an important constitutional issue.
Yeah.
It's not clear to me whether it'll be internet or libraries or something, but everybody in this room understands that the law... There's always this tension between freedom of speech, terrorist rights, secret trials, that kind of stuff.
Right.
One of the great things about America is this debate occurs in the open, and we as a society as a whole can come to a rational outcome. And if we don't like it, we can replace the people who pass those laws.
Google CEO Eric Schmidt talking with Web 2.0 Summit Program Chair John Battelle. You'll find links to the Web 2.0 podcast in our show notes at O'ReillyNet.com/future. Moshe Cohen is a clown. If you're picturing a white-faced big circus clown, you've got the wrong idea. Moshe uses his voice and his body, but no words, to connect with his audience through clowning. He brought Clowns Without Borders to the U.S. in 1995 after traveling to Croatia with the French Clowns Without Borders. He explains that...
We call it clown in the world of performance, and yet it's no makeup or anything. There's a human being eccentric, absurd, and hopefully funny, and interacting with the audience in a subtle and sophisticated way occasionally. And I work in mostly nonverbal or non-word-led manners. I think it is all about presence, and it's all about the presence of this human being and how that person reacts to situations, or if there's several clowns on stage, how they react to the situations. And as far as being on stage in the clown world, you're really listening to what's going on and playing, if you want, with what's happening, you know, that you're not generating. So the laughter in the audience, or in this case, on the third floor, a little three-year-old girl deciding she wanted to change seats and then change back again. And that's very human, and we can laugh about that together, and that's what happened there. But it's my listening as a performer saying, no, it's not about me, it's about what's going on in the room. And that listening is very, the Zen people like the study of clown, because they, when they practice and they meditate, they're basically listening to their breath, and their focus and their presence and their awareness or their mindfulness is placed into their breath and just there. The Tibetan Buddhists will visualize mandalas, amongst other things. My hope has always been, in my role, I feel, my function is to bring light and humor into whatever arena I'm performing in, so to lift spirits through what I do. That's my goal, is to create laughter and just a good feeling. And it's the experience of live performance, which is getting actually rarer in the nowadays world. And yet, that connection, and going back to that whole spiritual thing, or whatever you want to call that, the visual spectacle is taken in by the eyes, and that's connected to the soul, if you like the expression, the window of the soul. So you could look at it as that's the filtering device, comes in first there and then up into the brain, whereas a verbal humor or a verbal goes straight to the brain usually. But then lately I've been wondering about music, because music, you hear it, and yet it really affects the soul. So, I mean, some music. So Clowns Without Borders is an organization, a humanitarian organization, that goes into refugee camps and crisis situations, and using laughter as a tool releases psychological tension. I mean, that would be the definition that it started with. It started with the Bosnian-Croatian-Serbian conflict in ex-Yugoslavia, and European performers, it's only 600 miles away, and driving there and doing shows, and developed out of that. There's, if you do the work, or if you see photos even, or video, it's clear that the joy that the performances create is worth more than money can define. And that for the performers who volunteer, and it's almost uniquely a volunteer organization as far as the performers going into places to work, are professionals, and they get a great satisfaction that's completely something outside of their normal professional life. At the same time that they're really making a change in the people's lives. Even though it's ethereal, even though it's only a moment, there, it brings community together in a place where they can celebrate, which if they're in a crisis situation, they don't always have access to. And you, just by bringing your theater there, create the environment to allow them to express joy and to bring that back into their lives. Obviously, it's not a fix for the situation they're in. But we're not trying to do that. We always go in after the hunger and the shelter and the medical needs have been met. Or at least we certainly that's our goal, because otherwise it's kind of like a slap in the face. Why are you coming in here? You know, we need food. We don't need a clown. And we also don't give away things. We believe that it's about sharing a moment of joy and laughter. And it's expanded because we want to do more than just that. So it's expanded not just in terms of the number of operations we do, but we do workshops as well in working with teachers and with kids directly. And we're still looking for the right pathway with that to share it so that it stays behind. So if you teach a kid to juggle or a bunch of kids to juggle, that's great. You know, they can juggle with rocks if they want. I mean, equipment does come into play, and acrobatics, for example, is a great thing, or just doing games with them. Another really interesting thing I discovered recently, or didn't realize, even though I have known this for a long time, is that they don't have school books, for example. There was some discussion about bringing books to the third world. Well, I was just in Sudan in March, and there were no school books. You know, there's a blackboard and a teacher, and they sit on benches, and they have notebooks to learn to read and write with, or to write with, I guess. But everything is learned by rote. And that doesn't exercise the imagination. And so what we found is that, and we discovered this because there's an organization working called War Child that's based out of, mostly out of Holland and out of Canada, who work with fostering the creative environment, and doing that through numerous ways. But just because they don't get that in school, and yet that is the energy that's going to help to heal the wounds, the trauma that comes out of being in a war situation, whether they're child soldiers or they're just children who are caught up in whatever conflict and had to move, or in more unfortunate, I mean, it can get radically worse as far as their situation. How do you create meaningfulness in entertainment, and then what is that? And for me, that boils down to a spiritual discussion in the short end of it, or the long end of it, depending on how you get there. But one of the roles of clown is to allow us to laugh about our problems. And it's also about to point out when there are problems that we're not addressing. Especially we see that in the Native American societies, some of the clowning traditions, and there's a lot of clowning tradition that goes way back in Native American societies, like the Hopis. And their clowns will clown general problems in society, like obesity and alcoholism and diabetes. And they will also clown tourists who come to certain public events and make fun of them or make fun with them. It is deeper if you decide to make it that, if you want to take on that role. And I've had conversations with Wavy Gravy around that. What is sacred clown? Because that's the role that you're talking about. And both we were both kind of uncomfortable. You can't call yourself a sacred clown. It's not a reality. that you can hold on to, is what he said. It's not something, he says, like jelly. He says, if you try to hold on to it, just you can't hold on to it. But you can take it on in the moment when it's present and take it on as a role. And I embrace that. And so I came up with the term sacred mischief, which is the action as opposed to the... And I think that's a good way to look at it, because people do that every day. There is a moment that's funny, you recognize it, you laugh about it. Or there's a situation and you want to break the ice and you do something that's funny and people laugh about it. Well, that's a clown moment, if you want to call it that. And it's a humor, it's a moment of humor. What's interesting in the United States, and one of the reasons I'm not living in Europe full time and here, is because clown in the United States has come so much to be about not just necessarily derogatory, but there's that, you're clowning around, it's a bad thing. It's also the image is unfortunately mostly established with Ronald McDonald, or Bozo is the image when you say clown. 94% of the population think of that image, which is fine that they think that, but we have a tradition that's very strong that goes back to the vaudeville years and all the silent clowns that were in the silent movies, the Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Langdon, Lloyd, and there's a whole tradition there. I had an interesting conversation with Utah Phillips, who's a folk singer extraordinaire, about his dad was a vaudeville theater manager. And he said, well, back in the days, I said, when? He said, the 30s. He said, clowning around, it meant being funny. It was about doing something that was funny. It wasn't about, you know, goofing off and creating trouble, or it was about somebody who was doing something funny. And it was respectful, you know. And in Europe, I was at a doctor's house, a very wealthy doctor's house, after a workshop. He wasn't at the workshop, but he started talking about clowns. He says, our most revered clown is Dimitri. And he started going on about how in Switzerland they revere this clown and how much they appreciate what he does. But that conversation I have not yet heard in the United States. And if they even wanted to have that conversation, well, who would that be? And getting back to the sacred clown figure, it's interesting that Wavy, so who are the sacred clowns? I said, well, you know, Monty Python, John Stewart. I mean, looking at current day, who's taking on that role? There's somebody who's reaching a lot of people and who's raising up laughter around things that there's tension around, and who's taking knocks at the power structures to some degree. I think it's a choice that you make when something happens, to laugh about it or not, for one thing. It starts there. It's about, you know, your sense of humor and having that present in your life, recognizing and embracing it. There are pathways for people who want to perform. I actually have started the Institute of Sacred Mischief and Contemplative Clowning at the Zen Center in Los Angeles. And we'll have a session from mid-January to mid-March. It will be broken up into several workshops and sessions and evening classes. So it will be for actors and Zen practitioners and people who just have a general interest in exploring that. Sometimes there's psychologists who show up, teachers. It's a varied, and it's a new school. This is its second year. And we'll see how it grows. And there are workshops out there. And there's clown, you know, there's workshops that focus more on the structure of clowns. So what does the clown actually do on stage, and learning things that they can do. And so it's the action themselves that are funny. And then, like, I work more with the character. So what are your expressions? Where is your humor? How do you express it? Like, maybe somebody who likes to play overly serious. And by doing that is raising laughter, because we recognize the form and out there, and we recognize that they're having fun with it. I think one last thing I want to say is about positive humor, because for me, in the performance, I brought up a volunteer that I worked with, and we had a great time together. And I take as a performer, I take the volunteer into performance and ask them to be somewhat ridiculous, but with me. Not like, here, be ridiculous so people can laugh at you. It's, no, let's do something fun and have fun. And if the volunteer doesn't want to, I find somebody who does want to. But and positive humor for me is about not putting anybody down to get laughs, which we see a lot in verbal stand-up comedy. I mean, I think that's great that people laugh, but I prefer it where nobody is the victim.
Moshe Cohen from Clowns Without Borders USA. The final DTF piece, at least for now, is a remix I did of the episode 3 from David Bettino's O'Reilly podcast, The Digital Media Insider. Computer-synthesized voices are getting better all the time. The voice on the other end of the phone or even on your radio may have been generated by a computer. For example, this Japanese ballad. Is sung by a computer. If you listen closely, maybe you can tell it's not human, but the voice your computer uses to talk or sing to you has gotten a lot more realistic in the 45 years since the researchers at Bell Labs programmed this classic on a mainframe computer.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer.
Like almost anything else, though, the better it gets, the better we want it to be. The first voice you hear when you need help over the telephone or at your computer is often computer-generated. For example, I'm typing up this script and I accidentally leave off one of the L's in accidentally. The spell checker program has been quietly watching what I type, ready to suggest corrections. It immediately warns me of a
misspelling.
Digital media online editor David Bettino loves everything about this program's spell catcher, except that
the error sounds are awful.
It helps him spot errors and quickly correct them, but this isn't the voice you want to hear warning you about a problem with your
capitalization.
Do you hear the
hiss? Microphone thumps, and zombie-like performance.
These problems were too much for Bettino, so he headed over to the AT&T online speech synthesizer and created his own more natural-sounding warnings and swapped the sound files into his computer. Now,
capitalization
becomes
capitalization,
a rich, warm, friendly voice. If you prefer, you can have a French maid let you know when you need to correct your
capitalization.
The AT&T speech synth combines short recordings of actual speakers. Not only do you have a wide range of voices to choose from, you really don't need to restrict yourself to spelling and grammar prompts. Here's a British voice spouting nonsense.
Boop, bop, sneedly snot.
Once you've taught your computer to speak the way you want it to, it isn't much of a stretch to teach it to sing. Bettino tightened up the rhythm and added in other computer-generated sounds.
Boop, bop, sneedly snot. Snip, snap, sneedly bat.
Okay, that's not really singing. The computer is still speaking, but you're moving in the direction of music. Listen to what happens when you combine a computer's spoken voice with music. Kind of a computer karaoke.
Going down.
Party.
Time.
My friend.
Are.
Gonna be there.
Dictionary Oki features computer voices speaking along with familiar songs like AC/DC's Highway to Hell, performed by the former Yugoslavia. So far, we've mostly heard the computer's speaking voice. Computers can now sing as well, at least a little bit. The Dalai Lama synth sounds somewhat like a Tibetan monk. We can take a step closer to a natural singing sound with Vocal Writer,
which combines a MIDI sequencer with a sound generator.
Bettino talked to Vocal Writer's programmer, who explained that
conventional sequencers don't work well for singing synthesis, because the synthesizer needs to look ahead to determine how to make transitions between words.
The result is that Vocal Writer produces a more familiar sounding ballad.
She's out of my life.
Okay, that wouldn't pass for a real voice, but Vocal Writer can also scat. These sounds come from a computer. You're synthesizing voices. You can play with sounds that don't sound anything like real singing, like the alien sounds in this piece by Joe Hogan. Voices are generated by the Yamaha Vocaloid, which Bettino says is probably the most advanced singing synthesizer today. The Vocaloid produced the Japanese ballad you heard before. Zero G is a company that sells English voices for the Vocaloid. Like the AT&T voices,
the voices are based on recordings of actual singers.
You can hear that it's getting closer to a real singing voice.
Come on, yeah, yeah. Sing to me, baby.
getting close. In fact, we're getting close enough that these synthesized voices work fine as background vocals. They just aren't real enough to use out front. This is Andy Power on vocals and guitar, backed up by the computer-generated voices.
So you're planning to go like a dreamer over the fence to where the grass is looking greener. Well, I know a little bird told me so. A little bird told me there and then how you've changed with the weather since...
Whether you're interested in making your computer's vocal commands sound richer and friendlier, or whether you'd like to have your computer sing along with you, check out David Bettino's Episode 3 of the Digital Media Insider. You'll find the link in our show notes. Thanks to David Bettino, Moshe Cohen, Eric Schmidt, and John Battelle. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks also to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at atmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Biaspeak, and Audio Hijack Pro.